Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call, did write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of a man who is definitely on the naughty list to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this post-COVID Christmas special week is the argument to moderation, also known as the middle ground fallacy or argumentum ad temperantium.
Yeah, you've been ill, haven't you?
I have. So ill.
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of moderately ill. The whole COVID experience is a bit like having a cold, but without the familiar time, because we've all had enough colds that you know how it's going to go. So, you know, mine comes in as a tonsil thing, and then it turns into a nose thing, and then a cough thing, and then I know it's on the way out. Didn't have any of that. It didn't do it in the right order, but I felt like having a cold, but also an out of body experience at the same time, and a temperature, and then on top of that, you get up to go and get something to eat for breakfast, and then that wipes you out for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
Just minor amounts of activity, and then you have to go sleep it off. I mean, even sleeping was making me tired. It got to that, you know, lying down in bed was a tiring thing to do. and it just got boring after a while. And so couldn't kind of do anything. And I think the out-of-body experience also is probably what brain fog is, where I couldn't concentrate on anything for any length of time because it just wouldn't make sense. So TikTok was perfect because just, 25 seconds, that was about it. That's all you could deal with. Yeah, I missed Vine. 7 seconds probably would have been ideal. So, yeah. But then 10 days after I tested positive, I tested negative. So that was quite encouraging, watching the offending red line go slightly fainter. It was losing some of the yellow out of it. So it's going kind of more purplish towards the end. So it's like, yeah, having done, that amount of colour correcting, you're very aware of that. And you go, oh, yeah, look, that I should correct that for it's losing some yellow. But thankfully, back in time to do Christmas.
Yeah.
Yeah, so thanks for hanging on, everybody. And thanks for the kind comments from and the unkind comments for the people on the Facebook group. They're all very much appreciated. Thanks very much.
Yeah, the unkind comments were mostly people you knew, not listeners.
Yeah. No, they were just pull your finger out and do something about it. Yeah.
So, yeah, the argument to moderation is where the assumption is made that if there are two arguments, usually opposing, usually at extremes, then the real answer, the best answer, the most logical one, the truth, is in between them. Ideally, kind of right in the middle.
Right.
Which can possibly sometimes be the case, that a compromise between two extreme positions is the best answer. But assuming that is always the case is a fallacy, because sometimes one of those people is just wrong.
Yeah. Yeah,
one of the answers might actually be right. It doesn't necessarily follow that if two people disagree, the answer is somewhere in between their opinions.
It can be actually
just one of the people who has got the right idea.
Yeah, well, it's a bit like the BBC's balancing act when they say, and for balance, we're going to have. So we've got lots of climate change activist scientists and, right thinking people over here, and for balance we're going to have an idiot that just doesn't believe any of that.
Yeah. And that actually where they seek false balance essentially is the balance fallacy, which is slightly different from this, in as much as the assumption with the balance fallacy is that all opinions are equal, essentially.
Right.
yep. that the people who reckon the Earth is flat have just as much right to have their voice heard as the people who yeah. know the truth. So, yeah. That's not quite the same right. as this, because they're not saying the one in between.
Yeah,
if you listen to flat yeah. earthers and globe earthers, then the answer is probably somewhere in between.
Somewhere in the middle.
That's not really the argument they're making in that case. They're saying, we should listen. We should have balance. And with the climate change things,
right.
The conclusion that the journalists come to in that case isn't. It's probably somewhere in between what the climate scientists say and the climate deniers say. They just they teach the controversy.
Yes, and if they did do that, they did, talk to NASA and say, perhaps it's somewhere in between. That's more likely to be the truth than that's just because it's in the middle, then that's the fallacy.
Yeah. So, unusually for this show, this is a fallacy that Trump doesn't actually commit, at least Ooh. If you believe him.
Right. okay. Right. With that caveat. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah.
And the reason for that is because of his negotiation style.
Ah, of course. Yes.
Because his style is not to favour the middle, but to take an extreme position. Ideally, if he's arguing kind of to how much he should have to pay for something.
Right.
Yep. The very, very lowest amount.
Yeah.
Preferably nothing.
Preferably zero. Yes. Yes. If we can get away with it. Yeah.
So I found apart from his book, The Art of the Deal, which he didn't really write, he said stuff to Tony Schwartz and he wrote it down.
Right.
And this is when he claimed that he bought his first kind of private jumbo jet. And it was a 727. He bought it from a company that was having trouble. And he says in the book, a new 727 sells for approximately $30 million. A G4, Gulfstream 4, which is one-fourth the size, goes for about $18 million. However, I knew that Diamond Shamrock were hungry to sell and that not very many people were in the market for 727s. I offered $5 million, which was obviously ridiculously low. They counted at $10 million, and at that point, I knew I had a great deal, regardless of how the negotiation ended. Still, I haggled some more, and we finally agreed on a price of $8 million. So they did, essentially, start at two extremes and agree on a compromise in the middle.
Yeah.
And this is a kind of common negotiation tactic that people go for. If you're trying to sell something on eBay at like a buy it now price, but with an offer, people will kind of put in a low offer and you'll go, well, okay, let's split the difference and go kind of halfway in between. But the problem is that as soon as as soon as one of you offers to split the difference, essentially, what you're doing is your position is now that is now your where you've moved to, and you're saying you're prepared to accept that. So that gives the other person the opportunity to split the difference again between where they were and where your new position is.
Yeah.
And they end up getting a much better deal.
Yeah.
What happened in this case is that he has done what psychologists call anchoring by telling you, first off, that a new 727 sells for approximately $30 million.
Right.
It's not fully accurate at the time the book was written, but it was in the region.
Yeah.
Is it somewhere in between kind of the, mid-20s and 30 million? But this wasn't a new 727 that he was buying.
No.
It was like 30 years old. So. So, no, that absolutely wasn't worth anywhere near 30 million.
No.
In fact, I found newspaper articles from the time which talked about the cost of private jets. And there were two organizations quoted that essentially price up this kind of thing and were adjusting. And this the book was written in 1987.
Yeah.
This happened in 1987. The book was written slightly after, but this what the negotiation he's talking about in 1990, they were saying that a 727 was worth somewhere between, depending on what kind of 727 it was, somewhere between $3 million and $6 million.
Oh, Right. Okay.
There was
okay.
There
in
was
1990. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I also found an NTSB crash report from 1988, so the year after Trump bought his 727.
Yeah.
Of a 727, a Delta one, which had crashed, and the NTSB valued the cost of the plane at $6 million. I think it's $6.5 million.
Right.
So basically,
he
offered $5 million, which was pretty much what they cost that kind of age of plane.
Yeah.
And got negotiated up to $8 million by the company that was in trouble. And he thought, I've got a really good deal here.
So his art of the deal, the art of the deal in the art of the deal, is to sell us, the reader, the idea that he's a great haggler and a great at the art of the deal by feeding us some information to orient us to thinking, oh, right, yeah, these things are really expensive. So even the thing which he wasn't buying, which he mentioned for no reason, a G4, which is one-fourth the size, goes for about $18 million. But
yeah,
I wasn't buying one of those.
That was what other people were kind of buying at the time, was the Gulfstream 4 was like the thing to have. He bought a 727, which was like four times the size.
Right.
And he got it for way cheaper than a new Gulfstream 4.
Yeah.
Because it was 30 fucking years old at the time.
30 years old. And really difficult to fly into private jet-sized airports.
Yeah.
For one. Because they'll go, no, we haven't got room for 727. Sorry.
Yeah.
You've got a Gulfstream 4. We can accommodate that. No problem.
Oh, yeah. We get those flying in and out all the time.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. No. You're going to have to go to Rome and then and get the train. Sorry. Yeah.
So I've read people who have said about negotiation that this is a kind of a common thing in that people don't know how good negotiators they are. People assume they're better negotiators than they are. And the reason is because you never know what the other person was prepared to pay or go down to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's how negotiation works. At some point you agree on something and you each walk away from it thinking, oh, I did really well there. But you can't know. You can only know if you got a better deal than you were prepared to let go.
Yes, exactly.
Like if you had 10 million to spend and you got it for 5 million, then I guess you got a good deal. But it doesn't necessarily mean you got one over on the other people if they were prepared to take 2 million.
Yes, exactly. So they're doing as much as they can to hide their excitement, you know, their little fists drumming on the table and they're like, going, oh my God, he's going to give us 5. Yeah. Well, that's the thing when you get those reports from people in your life when they come back from the shop and they have bought something and you say, well, that's nice. How much was that? And they say,
it was on sale.
It was on sale. It was less than half price. Yeah. Well, how much was it still? What is that? It's a piston engine. Yeah. How much was that? £400,000. But it was on half. Yeah. Or you don't get the price. You just get. Oh, my God. It got a real bargain.
Oh,
it was a bargain.
Such a good deal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a piston engine. Why did you buy it? I panicked. It was a bargain. Yeah. Such a good deal. Other times, you will say to somebody, well, that's nice. How much was it? And they would tell you the price straight away. They go, oh, yeah, it's £5 in TK Maxx. TJ Maxx. Yeah. Don't. It's just nice. Just leave it at that. Unless it's very expensive. Uh-huh. And then you get it was 400% less.
No, I do have a tendency to tell people, oh, this was, I got a really good deal. How much? It was really cheap.
I got such a great deal. Yeah. Uh-huh. Meanwhile, the people over there in, you know, Computer Exchange are going, oh my God, we could have, you know, it's like £1.50 we had it on there. He misread it. It's $150.
So, if you believe Trump, he goes for the extremes. If you believe Ted Cruz, Trump is perfectly prepared to compromise. This is what Ted Cruz said back when they were trying to negotiate the government shutdown situation around the border security. Trump basically wanted 5.7 million, billion, probably. I don't know, a lot of money. He wanted the wall to be completely funded. It was 5.7 billion he wanted for the wall.
Yeah.
And said he wasn't, you know, he would veto any funding proposal that didn't fully fund the wall.
Yeah.
And Ted Cruz went on the Sunday shows and had this interaction with Chuck Todd.
I hope on Monday what we'll see is finally Washington coming together and opening up the government. What that's going to take is for the Democrats to move off the position that they've been taking so far of no compromise, no movement, their extreme position they've got to be willing to give in on.
Does the president, though, need to move? He hasn't moved at all publicly, and it's not clear what the offers are other than concrete to steal.
Chuck, that's actually not accurate. The president has said over and over again, I've been in the room when he said it, that he's more than willing to compromise. He's more than willing to meet in the middle.
I mean, that doesn't sound like Trump.
No.
And it's definitely not what he was saying publicly. Publicly, he was saying there is no movement. The wall is going to be fully funded. And he said on camera, I am happy to shut down the government for border security. Yep. I will take the blame on this. I will not blame you, talking to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer.
Yeah.
Of course, he did blame them immediately.
He did it in the White House. It was on. Yeah, yeah. Yes, he got really arsy with them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he was very, very clear that he wasn't taking a penny less than $5.7 billion. After costing the US about $11 billion by shutting the government down for several weeks, he basically went completely back and took absolutely nothing. He signed the bill that the Democrats had put through weeks before that had no funding for the wall whatsoever. But yeah, he was not prepared to compromise, no matter what Ted Cruz says.
And he didn't. So insofar as he didn't shift his position a little, he shifted it entirely and that didn't include it at all.
And in the case of the wall, if you believe, as I happen to believe, that spending billions to replace the existing border that was there with a taller border that you can just hand drugs through because there's big holes in it.
Yeah. Is it's big enough to put a seesaw through.
If you think that's a waste of time and money, then a compromise where you waste only $2.5 billion isn't a good compromise. Not wasting any money is the right answer.
Is the right answer. Yeah. The thing in the middle where you say, well, okay, you want $5 billion. We don't want you to spend any. So let's meet in the middle. We'll let you spend $2.5 billion.
Yeah.
No. It's yes, you're right. It, just because that's in the middle, we go, well, let's just sit around and what is it you want? What is it we want? Well, let's give you half what you want and an infinite amount more than we want to pay. Not twice, is it? Like from naught to $2.5 billion, not just twice. And then to say, well, that's the right answer. Well, it isn't. That would upset Trump because he wouldn't get what he wanted.
Yeah.
And it would upset the people that didn't want to give him anything to give him $2.5 billion. So clearly, just because it's in the middle doesn't make it right.
Our third example in Trump world comes from Elon
Speaking
Musk.
Speaking of just because it's in the middle doesn't make it right. Yeah.
And the reason this is quite Trump related and I'm not doing it in the Fallacy in the Wild bit. Yeah. Is because it followed Trump's Mar-a-Lago meeting with Kanye West, or Ye, and Nick Fuentes.
Fascist, as we call it.
Prominent white supremacist.
Right.
And
Kanye West, fascist.
That's the thing, because at the time, Trump defended himself and other prominent Republicans defended him by saying he didn't know that Nick Fuentes was going to be there.
Right.
Kanye, he agreed to meet, you know, he knows Kanye, he agreed to meet with Kanye, he came over for food and brought this anti-Semite with him.
Right.
And Trump doesn't know him, never met him.
Normally people bring a bottle of wine,
absolutely,
some flowers, some chocolates, something like that, you know, something to go with the bill. No, I brought an anti-Semite.
And supposedly...
Shall I put it in the fridge? Or
supposedly Ye was there to ask Trump to be his vice president. Because he's running for president.
Head.
And yet, the thing is, all of the defense came out of like, this awful anti-Semitic white supremacist, Nick Fuentes, we didn't know he was going to be there. We don't agree with what he wants and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
They were not at any point saying Trump shouldn't be meeting with Ye, who is exactly the same as that.
Yes, exactly, yeah. But a lot more famous and a deal richer.
And to the extent that he then, this was about a week before he went on Alex Jones's show.
Right.
And just talked about how much he loves Hitler for like 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
It was insane to the point. Yeah. It was so insane. Alex Jones was
told him to
was,
shut up.
Was yeah, like,
a bit shocked.
Oh, I don't know, this is a bit strong. I'm not really happy about this.
Alex Jones!
He was like, yeah, he was saying, you know, he said things like,
there's
a lot of people who, you know, deserve a lot of praise, especially Hitler. And Alex Jones was going, but, you know, people call you a Nazi. That's just not right, is it? And he was like, no, I'm a Nazi. I love Nazis. Nazis are great.
Yeah.
I love lots of things about Hitler. It was fucking insane. And
wow.
Ye had recently got his Twitter account back because of Elon Musk's applied free speech absolutism.
where he
thinks that some people should have the right to do and say whatever they want, and other people, he's going to do something about it if they do.
Like track his jet.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But in this case, Ye tweeted a swastika inside a Star of David thing and like a few other things like that. And Elon got rid of him again off Twitter. He decided that was a step too far and that he should have his Twitter account taken away. Obviously, people on the left weren't upset about that.
No.
People on the left are upset about a lot of the other stuff that Elon's been doing on Twitter.
Yeah, but not that.
People on the far, far right, like Nazis,
right,
were upset that Ye had been censored in this way for just being a Nazi. And, you know, what harm have Nazis ever done to anyone?
Especially in the hands of Ye. What harm has he ever done?
So basically, at that exact moment, everyone was pissed off with Elon for different reasons. And he tweeted, you know Twitter is being fair when extremists on far right and far left are simultaneously upset. Twitter aims to serve centre 80% of people who wish to laugh, learn, laugh and engage in reasoned debate. So the assumption that he has, it seems, from the beginning of that tweet, is that if people on both sides are angry with you, you're probably in the right place.
Yeah.
But he's not in the middle. He's way down to the right, far on the right.
Yeah.
It just happens there are people even further to the right.
To the right that are upset. Yes, exactly. Yeah, like even Attila the Hun is going, wow, that's a little bit extreme.
It's not, the compromise between Hitler wanting to kill all the Jews and everyone else saying don't kill all the Jews isn't kill half the Jews. That's not the right answer.
No. I mean, it's a bit like, it reminds me of when Greg Dyke was the Director General of the BBC, he famously said, if politicians on both the left and the right get upset with us, then we must be doing something right.
Yeah.
And
that's not necessarily true.
Not necessarily true. No, because really, are you representing the middle that don't get upset with you? Is that what you're saying? So,
if you run a pizza restaurant,
and
there's people who think that pineapple on pizza
is fine,
is a completely reasonable thing, and there's right-thinking people who believe that pineapple on pizza is an abomination.
Yeah.
And you shit on a pizza.
Yeah.
You've upset everyone, but you're not. That's not the right thing to do.
Yeah. No. No, that's right.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
So it's quite interesting, the employment of the notion of middle ground and the fallacy of using that as a kind of a diversion technique. And I think that's how it's used in British politics. There's this notion that like Musk's 80% of people, there's the British people who won't stand for this. And I think whoever's in the Republican Party of any note has said the American people won't stand for this. And Biden says the American people won't stand for that, and I'm serving the American people. And that's the kind of it's a camouflaging technique. It's a blindsiding technique for sneaking something through based on the idea that what you're doing is dealing with all the people in the middle, and that's therefore the right thing to do. So I'm coming at it from that point of view. In January of this year, the Labour Party called for a windfall tax on the billions of pounds of profits made by the energy firms. And in fact, Keir Starmer in Prime Minister's Questions at the time, quoted the head of British Petroleum, BP, called the energy crisis a cash machine for his own company. And so what Labour was suggesting, that this would pay for a freeze on the price of energy, because the price of energy had gone up and beyond the reach of many people to pay it. So, and as a consequence of that, as amongst everything else, the price of fuel had gone up. They were making money hand over fist. So the Labour Party suggested that they tax those profits in order to pay for a freeze. There will be a national freeze on the energy, so the energy companies wouldn't miss out, because the government would subsidise the payments by ordinary citizens by taxing the very profits that the energy companies would make. Quite a neat and costed exercise. But this is a bit too extreme a position for the Tory party. That's at one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is, let's not do anything at all. Let's do nothing. And that was the kind of the preferred position which we got an insight into when Liz Truss was running to be the Prime Minister for 44 days and be elected by the right wing. She was saying, we're not going to tax these profits. We're all about profit. Profit is a good thing. People will cease to invest if we tax their profits. So we're not going to do that. Therefore, what we're going to do is let the energy firms keep their profits and let the people pay. So that's the other extreme. But after a lot of pressure in the spring, finally in May, Rishi Sunak, who was then the Chancellor under Boris Johnson, finally suggested a windfall tax, and he said this.
We need to think about the fairest way to fund as much of that cost as possible. The oil and gas sector is making extraordinary profits, and for that reason, I am sympathetic to the argument to tax those profits fairly. But, as ever, there is a sensible middle ground. We should not be ideological about this, we should be pragmatic. It is possible to both tax extraordinary profits fairly and incentivise investment. We have built into the new levy a new investment allowance that means companies will have a new and significant incentive to reinvest their profits.
There was a lot of giggling at the time because they called it a temporary targeted energy profits levy and not a windfall tax, because then that would show that actually they would be doing what Labour had suggested 3 months earlier. And the use of the phrase middle ground does two things. It shows how this is anathema to the right wing of the Tory party, and also needs to be dressed in such a way that it appears to be pragmatic and not political. And he says it's a pragmatic solution, not a political solution. And yet it wasn't the solution either. because on the 9th of November this year, Keir Starmer asked Sunak, who is now leader of the Tory party, about how that windfall tax had actually affected the energy giants.
Take Shell. They made record profits this year, £26 billion. How much have they paid under his so-called windfall tax? Yes. Mr Speaker, there was no answer to the question because the answer is nothing. Yes. Shell haven't paid a penny in windfall tax. Yes. Why? Because for every pound they spend digging for fossil fuels, he hands them a 90p tax break. Yes. And it's costing the taxpayer billions.
So the compromise that they suggested, which was the middle ground, so, yes, we're going to tax these people. It's going to look like we've adopted the middle position, which is to actually effect this windfall tax, but to appease the right wing of the Tory party and to be seen to be the party of business, we're going to offer an incentive for people, for the energy companies, to invest. So, in taxing their massive profits, all the companies had to say was, yeah, we're going to invest this. Mm-hmm. So they got a 90% yeah. rebate. So they didn't pay any windfall tax at all. It just looked like they did. So the position between let's do nothing whatsoever and let's actually tax the fuck out of them so that they get paid from their own profits, which seemed to be perfectly reasonable, probably the right thing to do. They adopted the middle ground, which was to make it look like they were doing that, but also frig it so that they were getting their money back. And that's been the tale of the reason why Norway has made a massive amount out of North Sea oil and Britain hasn't. So basically, the middle ground turned out, in Sunak's case, to be a cover-up for not finding any solution whatsoever. So the second example, we're returning to my thesis about the BBC holding the middle ground, the balance fallacy versus the appeal to moderation. So here's Mick Lynch, the leader of the RMT Rail Workers Union, interviewed by Michelle Hussein on BBC Today programme 2 days ago, I think. She's asked him to enumerate the cost of his striking members' sacrifice in terms of wages.
You've said they're making a sacrifice. What's wrong with putting a number on it?
Well, why do you need that number?
Because I'm interested in the level of sacrifice.
But interested in what Network Rail and the government are doing to working people across this country and impoverish them every day? You put these lines that are directly taken from the propaganda from the other side. You never show any admiration for the fight that working people are putting up in this country, for the rebalancing of our society. You never criticise the super rich for what they're doing and what they're doing to nurses, what they're doing for the postal workers. And you never seem to take an impartial view on the way that this society is balanced at the moment.
So I think what he's doing is rejecting the line of questioning as the vis-a-vis the need to reveal how much people are sacrificing in terms of pay. He's as an extreme view at one end, and he's saying that's an extreme view punted out by the right-wing press, and it is. You know, they're kind of they're trying to demonise Mick Lynch by saying, well, you're making these people sacrifice in the way that they demonised the miners in the 80s for going on strike for a year against the Thatcherite machinations to destroy the unions and or to destroy anything that's more powerful than the Tories themselves. The Tories really don't like other people having any power whatsoever. So even though they're shit at being in power, they don't like other people being powerful and representing lots of other people in a kind of altruistic way. They think it should be attached to profit. So the right-wing media is trying to demonise Mick Lynch in saying you're making these people give up their wages during an economic crisis. And that's on one end of the spectrum. And I think what Mick Lynch neatly does in appealing to some moderation on the part of the BBC, what he neatly does is illustrate the other extreme of the views by saying, why aren't you talking about the sacrifices that working people are making every day at the hands of exploitative employees who are, perpetuating the unbalance of the economy in Britain today. It's a very neat trick insofar, and he is extremely good at it, in not answering the question and calling in to question the validity of the question itself, and at the same time shoving that down one end of the extreme by saying this is, you, and quite, he's quite right, because they're just peddling establishment / right wing media lines that these people are having to sacrifice things against their will, blah 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 blah, all of those things. He says that you're just repeating that stuff. So he shoves that down one end, and in appealing for the middle ground as the right thing to do, he's actually vocalising the views up the other end. Also, quite correctly, the views up the other end are actually the right views.
Yeah.
That's the thing. There isn't.
Yeah, he's not calling for a compromise between the two.
No, he's pointing just out saying, that I they want don't, you to have
yeah, they
some
only go
impartial.
On one extreme.
Yes, you only do this. I want you to adopt some impartiality vis-a-vis, not saying that kind of stuff, but also pointing out the extreme sacrifices that workers have made for the past 12 years at the hands of privately run for profit organisations that were publicly run for service up until the moment that they were privatised by the current Tory party government, who have no idea whether they're privatised or not because they're just ignorant of all that stuff. It's a really neat trick. And the thing about Tory party shills that are wheeled out to defend this stuff, they fall into the trap of, well, they don't answer the question, but of avoiding answering the question rather than calling into question why that question is being asked. He kept saying, well, why do you want to know a number? It's different for different people, of course, but the thing is, it adds up to the fact that they're prepared to sacrifice their wages in order to guarantee a better deal for the collective workforce.
Yeah.
That's what...
In a weird way, Mick Lynch kind of reminds me of Jennifer Lawrence. Because...
okay.
Stick with me. Because it's brilliant.
All right.
In that, rather than using it as a springboard to talk about what he wants to talk about, it's just like, well, what a fucking stupid thing are you talking about now?
This is
the issue that we are here to discuss, and this is why we're here. Jennifer Lawrence had this thing where she was like, she came across as not having had any media training when being interviewed about stuff. Like when she was at the Oscars and they were like, how did you prepare for the ceremony today? And she was like, I don't know, got up.
Put on some clothes.
Yeah. Got dressed, came in. What are you asking me? Yeah. What a stupid question. It's endearing, and it makes it not only tells you something about them as a person, but it tells you something about the kinds of stupid questions they get asked all the time. And Mick Lynch gets asked fucking stupid questions all the time by journalists who are trying to push a particular viewpoint by asking a question in a certain way.
And he
and
pricks,
expecting
he
him
the
and
bubble
he's just like, yeah, yeah, this is
in the
stupid.
Same way that Jennifer Lawrence does, it pricks the bubble of the pomposity of the self-importance of the environment within which those questions are seen to be meaningful.
Yeah. It's basically saying, why should I be expected to play along as if you've asked a sensible question?
Yes, exactly.
Why should I have to join in this facade when there's, you know,
when there's people
we could actually
are,
talk like humans.
Yeah, and there are people who are simply arguing for a better pay deal and more effective working
conditions.
Yeah,
it's not complicated.
No, it's not unreasonable. And it's the right thing to do. Calling for a compromise from that position is not the right thing to do. He was on the morning programme. So that was the morning programme on the radio, on the BBC, on the independent television. There's a morning programme called Good Morning Britain. And Richard Madeley, who is a non-entity that married another non-entity, was arguing with Mick Lynch. And at one point, Mick Lynch said, well, are you going to let me answer the question or are you just going to interrupt? You might as well be interviewing yourself. It's not unreasonable for workers that have been denied a pay rise for the past 5 or 6 years by a company whose chief executive has awarded himself a 200% pay rise over the same time. It's not unreasonable for them to ask for better working conditions and better pay. And it's not unreasonable to ask for the government not to intervene to prevent the chief executives from meeting with the unions, which is exactly what the government did. Because what the government's compromise is to stoke the culture wars so that the unions are continue to be demonised.
Yeah, because and that's why the journalists continue to ask, well, not even ask the question, just kind of point out, these strikes are very inconvenient for people. Yeah. Which, like, yes, that's the whole fucking point of a strike.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why they work.
How essential the service that we provide is. And if you didn't have it, it would inconvenience you. And it's not unreasonable for us providing that service to ask for a pay rise that's equal to inflation.
Yeah, at least vaguely connected to it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah.
Of unbiased commission, just like the one I used to own, where the premise proceeds to the conclusion and leads to teach you something you didn't know. Oh, but I'm hearing naught but wild fallacies with everyone who thinks they're right. May your bowels of COVID be mild, and may all your fallacies be wild.
Bing Crosby there, of course, with White Christmas.
Beautiful. So in The Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective, and this week our first example comes from Lost in Space.
Yay!
This is the 60s original
the TV series.
Lost in Space, the proper one.
Yeah, yeah.
not the Matt
We're not
LeBlanc
compromising
film.
On that. There's no middle ground on that either.
Or the more recent remake series. And this episode is all about prejudice.
Right.
The Robinsons are visited by an alien who they inexplicably find very handsome and is dressed all in gold. And Dr. Smith, Zachary Smith, finds him very, very charming.
Oh, he's charmed.
Utterly taken in by this guy. Only the young girl of the family is any the wiser about this guy.
Yeah.
But Mum is also quite sceptical. But he tells them that he is on this planet. He's come to the planet to kind of essentially have a duel with another alien who is very vicious and nasty, and they shouldn't kind of treat him nicely at all. They should assume that he's a bad guy. But you know, I'm nice. I'm the good guy.
Yeah.
And
I'm
you should
gold for
you
sh-
yeah
sake.
I'm made of gold. I'm very handsome.
Yeah.
And you should kind of also give me all your weapons so that I can fight my enemy.
Our golden friend, believe me, is as handsome in spirit as he is in appearance.
Well, before we pass judgment on Mr. Kima, I think that we should hear what the opposition has to say. You know, there are always two sides to every argument. And more often than not, the truth lies somewhere in between.
Sometimes one of them's right. Penny, the young girl, goes to visit the other alien, the one they've been told is
the
bad.
The ugly, horrible one.
He's ugly. He's not golden. Right. He's not attractive. He basically the way they've made him ugly is they've put a kind of papier-mâché frog head on him. And it's just like, absolutely hideous. As far as humans are concerned,
right.
But she sees past it. She sees the man inside and realizes that actually the golden alien who comes across as very charming and handsome is completely lying to them.
Yeah.
He is fully wrong and deceptive. It isn't somewhere in between the two of them. Like he is the aggressor.
Yeah,
he is deceiving his new friends.
Yeah.
He's not only wants to take their weapons so that he can shoot the person he's trying to kill, but also plans to kill them all.
Yeah.
Anyway, everything about that guy is bad. It's not somewhere in the middle.
And does it give Penny an insight into the duplicitousness of Dr. Smith?
I mean, they're well aware. Of Smith by this point, The wonder is by this point why they ever go along with anything he says or trust his instincts at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's always wrong about everything.
Well, that's because somewhere in the middle, more often than not, the truth lies. They're constantly seeking a compromise. Rather going,
they're very
forgiving. For fuck's sake, why don't we just shoot him? Nobody here is going to disagree with
it. It would save all the problems they have.
It would save all the problems.
So our second example comes from The Big Bang Theory. And this is an episode where they find a ring... from like a prop from Lord of the Rings, a kind of box of junk, and argue over who gets to keep it because they believe it is like one of the original kind of rings that was forged.
It's the ring
for the film.
All right,
and Raj says that he wants to sell it and buy a jet ski.
Mm-hmm.
That's his plan. Is he wants a jet ski for it?
Right.
And the others are kind of arguing about who gets to keep it.
Have you come to the realization that the only reasonable course of action is to sell the ring and divide the money?
No.
I was afraid of that. Go ahead.
Greetings from Mumbai. I am Raj's attorney, Venkatesh Kutrapali.
Also my cousin.
You brought a lawyer?
Don't answer that. I'll get straight to the point. My client's prepared to surrender any interest he has in the ring in exchange for two Kawasaki jet skis.
We're not giving him two jet skis.
Look, we're big boys. Why don't we just cut to the chase and meet in the middle? One Kawasaki jet ski, done and done.
No jet skis!
So, what he wanted was one jet ski.
So
they started at two.
With two,
so that they could be negotiated.
And the only reasonable position, obviously, the compromise that obviously people were going to go for, obviously, is one jet ski.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, in a very Mick Lynch kind of way. No, no jet skis. Yeah. No.
And that's the thing.
You can't have that.
If you're trying to sell your car for $10,000 and that's what it's worth, and someone comes along and says, I will give you $1. It's not reasonable to meet in the middle and sell it for $5,000.
No, even if they are former president of the United States, unless he thinks, this gremlin, they're very rare. You know, you can't get those for less than $17,000
for it.
I'll give you twice what you're asking.
So our third example comes from South Park, and this is the gay marriage episode.
Right.
This is the episode where it's pre federal gay marriage in the US at this point. It hadn't happened yet. And this is the governor of Colorado is being asked to make this difficult decision of whether he should allow gay marriage in his state.
I believe that I might have come up with a compromise to this whole problem that will make everyone happy. People in the gay community want the same rights as married couples. But dissenters don't want the word marriage corrupted. So how about we let gay people get married, but call it something else? you homosexuals will have all the exact same rights as married couples. But instead of referring to you as married, you can be butt buddies. Instead of being man and wife, you'll be butt buddies. You won't be betrothed, you'll be butt bodies. Get it? Instead of a bride and groom, you'd be butt buddies.
We want to be treated equally.
You are equal. It's just that instead of getting engaged, you would be butt bodies. And everyone is happy.
Well, what about lesbians?
Well, like anyone cares about fucking dykes. Oh, God, I was sure that would work.
Sure that would work. Yeah.
So, in attempting to find a compromise between people who just want to have the same rights as everyone else and the assholes who want to stop them from having those rights, he doesn't make anyone happy.
Yeah. So that, and again, it's that it's the same. It's the, that I'm very pleased to say Rishi Sunak is using the same techniques as
absolutely, yeah.
In saying that this is the compromise. And then selling you something that isn't a compromise at all. It's not. It's still something that negates your rights and adds insult to the injury of not having equal rights. My other one was my email signature says, the truth lies not in one of the disputed views, but in some third possibility, which has not yet been thought of, which we can only discover by rejecting something assumed as obvious by both parties. And I suddenly thought in researching this episode, ooh, perhaps that's an appeal to moderation. That's the middle ground fallacy, is that it's we can only find the truth by rejecting either of the truths that are assumed as obvious by either end of any particular argument.
Mm. So are you going to stop using that as your email signature now?
I might just add in brackets, or is this the appeal to middle ground fallacy? I think I'll do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or put a link to this episode in it.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Or is it? Link.
That's probably the safest way to do it.
That's the safest way.
Yeah, it's the only reasonable.
It's the only reasonable compromise. Yeah.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
You see, at one end of the, playing this game, which we have for hundreds of episodes, tens of episodes, at one end, there's Trump and his madness and my wish to have nothing to do with giving him any more oxygen to promote his lies any more than necessary. And at the other end, there's the wish to wheedle out any fakery in all its forms. So I've kind of gone for a happy medium, which I've realised has involved just like plain guesswork in my attempt to that. So, which just goes to show that when you're trying to reach compromise, all you have to do is guess.
Well, that's it. You're in luck. Because this episode does not feature Trump in this section. Because
thank God for that.
It's Christmas. And we like to we mix it up a bit at Christmas. Yeah. Different games. And this, as a special Christmas treat, I'm giving the opportunity to win three whole points.
Oh, my God. Here. I could get up and beyond the medium compromise, right?
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
So.
Okay.
There is a fella on Twitter who we have talked about before, who is one of Trump's most faithful, loyal acolytes.
Right.
He's a man called Nick Adams, in brackets, alpha male.
Right.
That's how he styles himself.
In case anyone's in any doubt. Right, okay, yeah.
And he tweets the most banal, untrue, bullshit, just pandering, ridiculous. It's to the point where it's indistinguishable from parody. There are people who are absolutely convinced that this Twitter account is parody.
Yeah.
And the only way I know it isn't, or at least I'm like 90% sure it isn't, is that he is, like, he frequently appears on his Twitter account in kind of selfie videos that he does himself. You know, it's definitely him. It's definitely his account. And if he is doing a parody, he is fucking committed to the bit. He has written multiple books about Trump. He is Trump appointed him to the board of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, which is a fucking joke, in 2020. He is fully in for Trump, anti-LGBT, and like supported Amy Coney Barrett's nomination, supported Brett Kavanaugh.
Right.
He's really, really committed if it is a bit. Yeah. But he's so insane, it could still maybe be a bit.
It might.
I'm not absolutely ruling it out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
What I have is a series of tweets by him.
Yeah.
I have three sets of three. And each set, one of them is one I made up.
Right. Okay.
So, set number one.
Right, yeah.
Tweet number one.
Yeah.
Prince Harry is a beta male who takes instruction from his wife and has never been to a Hooters.
Because that's the mark of an alpha male.
It absolutely is in Nick Adams' view. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like his favourite place.
Right.
Tweet number two.
Let's face it, it's the only way he's going to get near to a girl.
Yeah. Number two, Herschel Walker was one of the strongest candidates for US Senate in recent history. Statement number three.
Yeah.
John Voight is a better actor than Tom Hanks will ever be. Audiences hate woke beta males.
John Voight's played some woke beta males before woke beta males were. He's played. Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. Prince Harry's a beta male, so take instructions from his wife and everything. So I quite like the Herschel Walker one. It's a straightforward one, which could belie the gymnasts behind it. Okay. And John Voight. See, that's a very, in a way, that's a gym giveaway, given our predilection for film. John Voight and John Baxter. Okay, I think then. Okay, I'm going to go for number three is the one you made up.
Okay, and number three, because I haven't got anything to play you, because they're tweets. I'll just tell you.
Okay.
Number three is...
Yeah.
The one I made up.
Hey! Oh, Jesus Christ. So that means...
You've got
Herschel
a point.
Walker was the strongest candidate. That's a real
thing he said.
Wow.
Which is a fucking sick burn on all of the other Senate candidates in recent history.
Given how successful he was. Yeah. Oh, my God. Wow. Yeah, the Prince Harry's a beta male. That's a very... It rings true of alpha males. Yeah, well, it rings true of males who can't deal with strong women.
Yes, yeah, that's the thing. They hate Meghan Markle, like Piers Morgan. He hates Meghan Markle because she's a strong, intelligent woman, and he can't cope with that. So,
no,
yeah,
right. So, great, one, yay,
woo! 1 point.
Oh, it's like Christmas. Yeah, brilliant. All righty, okay.
Set number two.
Uh huh.
Tweet one. Nobody knows the Constitution better than Donald J. Trump, full stop.
Right.
Tweet number two.
Yeah.
If Donald J. Trump had been president in 1939, Hitler wouldn't have invaded Europe.
I think Ye would disagree. Yeah. Well, actually, reading that out to Kanye, it's a bit like when Spock says something to a computer and makes it self-destruct. Uh-huh. If you said that to Kanye, it would just explode, wouldn't he?
And tweet number three.
Yeah.
Alpha males should strive to have a better relationship with their butcher than their wife.
thrive. It's a very odd verb to use.
You've
there.
Got to put the work in yeah. to your relationship yeah.
with
your with
butcher. Your
butcher.
Because you have a relationship with your wife, but basically she's your wife, and then, but you should, on top of that, you should strive. Oh, that's a reminder of a conversation we had last night. I was rehearsing with the band of who made all the music in the show. So yeah, go check it out. And Ian, the singer, was telling us how he strives to have a good relationship with the people that collect his trash, the bin collectors. And goes and gives them a Christmas bonus. Mm. And consequently, he could put anything out and they would take it away.
Like a dead body.
Dead body, exactly. That was my first thought. One of those suspiciously rolled up carpets. Yeah. Oh, it's just an old carpet. A bit lumpy carpet, is it, Ian? Yeah, yeah, he will take that. No problem. Yeah, just shove it in the masher. Be fine. Yeah. Yeah. Alpha male should strike. Okay. I think that I really like the Donald J. Trump should be president. That, Okay, in that one, I got a terrible feeling that I'm choosing the one. Nobody knows the Constitution. I think that number two is the one that you made up.
Okay.
Because it's such a, but it's because it's a good gag.
And number two?
Yeah.
Is?
Yeah.
Fake news. That's the one I made up.
Oh, what? It's like,
you're on fire.
Oh, see? Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God. So that means you should strive to have a better relationship with your butcher than your wife. It's a real thing. Uh-huh. Oh, dear. And also, see, the thing that nearly tipped me to number one was full stop.
I wondered if it might. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But he is, Nick Adams, as American as apple pie, is Australian, which is why he said he's Australian by birth, American by choice.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. Bring it on. Number three.
Tweet number one. Mm-hmm. I'm in Europe right now, and the people here love President Trump. The media is lying when they say President Trump's policies are not popular here.
Right.
Tweet number two. This morning I was asked if I wanted oat milk in my coffee. I informed the girl behind the counter that it's not physically possible to milk an oat and immediately left the coffee shop. I will never return.
Oh, I bet they're really sad at its disappearance. Right. Milk and oat. Right.
Tweet number three.
Right.
Melania Trump is the most impressive female world leader since Cleopatra, and it's not particularly close.
That's a very odd qualifier, isn't it? Okay, the most people... A world leader in what? Okay. Yeah. All right. Europe might know the people here love President Trump. Okay. I really desperately want oat milk to be real. Melania Trump's most of it. I think, right, that the... not particularly close. I think, given that he is who he is, an American by choice, but an Australian. All right, okay, I think number three is the one you made up. Most impressive female world leader since Cleopatra.
Okay.
Yeah.
And number three.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah.
Real. That was a real thing.
Oh, bloody hell.
I don't know what part of the world he thinks she leads or has ever led.
Exactly. And how is that impressive given what we know about Cleopatra and the times in which she...
I mean,
existed.
Impressive it's since really quite Cleopatra. Impressive. So, like you know, Cleopatra was better, but since Cleopatra, there hasn't been a more impressive
World leader.
Thatcher like or
the Queen,
Angela Merkel,
Indira Gandhi.
Yeah, I mean, there's a gold in my ear. I mean,
yeah.
Jacinda Ardern, Jesus Christ, she's the most impressive female world leader in a long time.
Yeah,
Sanna Marin, the Finnish.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's just there's so many. There's so many great examples.
Since Cleopatra,
Melania would not be on the list.
Not be in
she
the
wouldn't
list.
Be. She wouldn't be a long way down. She doesn't make the list.
No.
So
no. Because she's not impressive,
yeah,
or a world leader.
So, the one that is not Nick Adams in this group is number one. I didn't.
Oh, what?
I didn't.
So the oat milk is real.
The oat milk is real. I mean, it didn't happen. That no, it was just a thing he made up. But
yeah,
I didn't make up number one. Number one, is another Trump sycophant called Bridget Gabriel.
Right.
Who is? I mean, if I didn't know that Nick Adams, like I'd seen videos of Nick Adams and I've seen videos of Bridget Gabriel, if I didn't know that, they were the same people. They're the same. Right. They basically tweet kind of very similar stuff.
Yeah.
And it's, So it was a little bit of a tricky one. But but yeah, that was a thing she made up quite recently.
Wow. Yeah.
And all the Europeans on Twitter instantly went, that's bullshit.
That's bullshit, yeah. I don't know who you talk to, but we don't want that. Thank you very much. Whereas Melania, one of the world leaders that we can't fail to be impressed by. No, did I say can't? I mean...
I can fail, yeah.
Yeah.
Not
can
even
only.
Hard.
No, and only.
I absolutely. Yeah. I frequently fail to be impressed by her.
Yeah. Constant. I think it's probably safe to say all the time. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So as it's Christmas.
Yeah.
There's
double it up.
There's an extra bonus.
Oh.
For patrons, which we will, which is another fake news. This one will be featuring recent things by recently defeated senatorial candidate Herschel Walker.
Right.
And it won't be scored because we have to have integrity in the game and, this is only going to be for patrons. So so if you want to hear that, if you're not a patron, you can join at patreon.com/ftrump. Well, you got two of the ones correct. So what we're going to do is I'll increment the total by one, because we've one episode, but I'll give you 2 points for this episode, you see.
Ooh,
so you're now on 52 out of 104, which is, but you're back up to 50%.
Woohoo! There you go.
Merry Christmas.
See what we've done there is we've gone for the middle ground.
Yeah.
We bargained. Yeah. Merry Christmas. Banging Christmas.
Time of compromise.
Fantastic. What a marvellous present. Thanks so much.
So it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called Jack Smith is Not a Logical Fallacy.
It's such a cool name as well. It's kind of like, it's like...
No nonsense.
Yeah,
just,
exactly. It's, it's sort of Jason Bourne, it's Reacher, it's all of that. It's, it's a proper secret agent's name, isn't it? It's an all-action hero kind of name, isn't it? It's not John. It's not John. It's Jack.
Uh-huh.
So it's a little. There's a little bit of a little bit of a square bottle of whiskey involved. He's slightly ugly. He's a bit rugged. He's an all action hero.
He looks like a scary motherfucker. Actually,
I know.
He's
and quite young. He's been doing it for 30 odd years.
When it was first announced, they grabbed a photo of him wearing this kind of purple fronted outfit. And people on Twitter were like, oh, is he like an enterprise captain or something? And And then people who'd actually looked it up were like, no, that's the outfit he wears for prosecuting war criminals at The Hague.
Yeah. It's no messing about. Exactly. Okay, yeah. So, all right, we're going to get another one. It's going to be another kind of Muller kind of guy who's just going to be a bit circumspect and kind of go, there's no examples of where we couldn't say that they didn't do blah, blah, blah. No. He's prosecuted war criminals at The Hague for a decade.
Chief prosecutor in the International Criminal Court in Hague.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he knows what the fuck he's doing. He has carried out some very complicated prosecutions. He has not shied away from bringing prosecutions where there wasn't like a guaranteed win to happen. It was like, you know, this is a thing which needs to be adjudicated in court. So I'm going to bring it anyway and we're going to do it. He was appointed essentially when Trump announced that he was running for president, because Merrick Garland was ensconced in various investigations against Trump, basically the January 6th and the Mar-a-Lago ones in particular.
Yeah.
And at that point, it became politically difficult because realistically, Trump is going to be running against Biden. There's an appearance of impropriety, no matter how how it's done. So at that point...
If that was the Republicans, they'd just go, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Whereas Democrats going, looks a bit dodgy.
So at that point, the sensible thing to do is to put someone else in charge of this investigation who is separate from the DOJ, essentially. He's separate from Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland appointed him, has the ability to fire him, but would have to make a good case as to why. He would have to go to Congress, basically, if he wanted to fire him, and argue why Jack Smith had not done his job properly or had not been performing his duties. He can't just say, you're not doing it anymore, I'm taking over.
Yeah.
And Congress can't fire him either. The only person who can fire him is the Attorney General, and again, he has to show cause. He kind of is allowed to get updates from Smith of how the investigation's going and what's going on, but he isn't overseeing the investigation. Smith is in charge of it.
Right.
So that kind of separates it out a bit, and it means that the person who Biden appointed isn't in charge of the investigation. And he's got quite a broad scope in the investigation. He has been essentially assigned to look at the Mar-a-Lago documents case where Trump stole secrets and took them back to his golf club, and the January 6th insurrection.
Yep.
And things that come out of that investigation, including potentially obstructions into those investigations, fall under the scope of the stuff that Jack Smith is allowed to look at and encouraged, in a way, to prosecute if he finds crimes. And that is one of the ways in which this is quite different from Robert Mueller. His investigation, because his scope was quite artificially narrowed by Rod Rosenstein, the acting Attorney General at the time, or Deputy Attorney General, I think, at the time, who it came out after the whole investigation had various conversations with Mueller, kind of narrowing his scope and saying he was really only allowed to look at kind of basically whether they could prosecute Trump, which...
Right.
Mueller kind of went into it with the OLC memo, the Office of Legal Counsel memo, saying you can't indict a sitting president, kind of having that already decided for him. So his report became, here are crimes he committed. here's the memo that says we can't prosecute him. There's not a lot I can do about it.
Kind of
saying, you know, Congress do something about it. Congress, you know, take the next step.
Yeah.
For Smith, none of that is the case, because his scope is more broad. He's allowed to bring in other crimes that come up in the course of what he's looking at. And also, there's no Office of Legal Counsel memo that says you can't indict a former president. That's fine. Hasn't been done before, but there's no legal reason why it couldn't be done.
Yeah.
And one of the other main differences is that when Mueller was brought in, he essentially had to form a team and an office of investigation and start from scratch and look at everything himself. Yep. And everything was separate to what the DOJ were doing. Smith has been brought in essentially to oversee the investigations that the DOJ have already been running with. Yep. Yep. So he is taking over that team, supervising that team and running the investigation from this point on. So there is an infrastructure already there. There's agents there. There are you know, people who know what they're talking about. He seems to already know what he's talking about based on the stuff he's been doing so far.
Yeah. He's kind of wasted no time, has he? That the bit that amused me is that he was supposed to take up the position some weeks ago, earlier, but he'd suffered a bicycle accident. So he's based in the Netherlands, which is a bicycle-friendly place. It's flat. And to have suffered a bicycle accident sufficient to prevent him from leaving the Netherlands and coming to the States, that's how badass he is. Fucking fast must you have been riding, and how dangerous to suffer a bicycle accident. In what's a bicycle-friendly... I mean, when you try and cross the road in Amsterdam, for instance, it goes pedestrians, massive bike lane, then the trams, then the cars, and then the other way, the cars, the trams, and the bike lane, and then pedestrians.
Yeah.
So you've really got to be doing something absolutely outrageous to suffer a bicycling accident sufficient to stop you leaving the country.
I mean, it didn't stop him for long.
No.
And it didn't stop him from getting involved almost immediately.
Yeah.
Within a week of being appointed, he sent a letter to the 11th Circuit. This is the Judge Eileen Cannon, who had given Trump the special master, Raymond Deary, on his documents case, citing anomalous jurisdiction, which she basically made up and the Trump team didn't even ask for, despite her basically going, I'll definitely go with anomalous jurisdiction if you suggest it.
If you suggest it,
But she did it on her own.
What are you saying? Oh, for Christ's sake, I'm going to do it for you.
So the Department of Justice appealed that decision quite reasonably. And Jim Trusty, one of Trump's lawyers, in answering that appeal, he gave it, at oral arguments, he was asked by the 11th Circuit judges for any examples of other cases where this has been the case, where there's been because he claimed that the government should be enjoined by the court to provide the special master, essentially, to allow the special master to continue. And so the court said, okay, well, give us an example of a case where that's happened. And he couldn't, which is not great. One of the things that you see in anything you watch about lawyers is they tend to be citing cases when they
we ought to do it like this because the last time this was done like this,
that guy so he couldn't come up with a name. He couldn't come up with a case about where it was done. But the next day, he wrote them a letter and went, oh, I thought of one. This is brilliant. can't believe I didn't think of it on the top of my head. The one that you want to know, the one that you're asking about, it's the Rudy Giuliani case. Remember when the FBI raided Rudy Giuliani's office and they stole all those documents?
That's the precedent.
He got a special master to check whether those documents were privileged information. And the court went, I mean, it's not a great analogy, is it? And
involves Giuliani.
And so Jack Smith wrote a letter on Thanksgiving Day to the 11th Circuit saying, okay, you know, defense counsel has made this case, or Jim Trusty's made this case. He's referred to this Giuliani case. Here's the reasons that's not the same. Among the reasons are that was the lawyer's office. not someone's home.
yeah.
The government wasn't enjoined by a court. They volunteered, like they decided to do the special master thing.
Yeah.
So, no. And also, then nobody argued anomalous jurisdiction at all in that case. So, yeah. So all the things that you're looking for in terms
it's
of
the same yeah, as
no, yeah. None of those are true.
No.
And subsequent to that, possibly because of that, the special master has since been removed from the case, mm-hmm. and the Department of Justice have access to all of those documents that they yeah. seized in the search warrant that was granted when they were looking at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's fair to say that he got that, he made that happen, but he certainly weighed in on that case in a way that kind of smacked down Jim Trusty.
It kind of reminds me that his approach reminds me of that Australian interviewer that interviewed Trump.
Jonathan Swan.
Yeah, who just went, was like...
None of that is true. You can't do that.
The emperor's new clothes. He just said, what are you talking about? You can't do that. Well, I'm the president. I go, no, you can't. You're showing me these numbers, but they don't... You're using numbers in a way that doesn't exist. That's... But yeah. I'm the president. No, that doesn't make any difference. You can't... change the way that objective truths are viewed. And that's what Jack Smith, he's kind of come in as the deus ex machina in the Crucible, who kind of comes in and says, no, what are you doing? These aren't witches. You've just perpetuated your class war in the name of Jesus Christ. What are you doing? And it's amazing to me that it's taken this long for somebody who's sensible,
yeah,
somebody who does stuff in the real world to be assigned to this. So,
I mean, I think if Smith hadn't been appointed at this point, those are exactly the arguments the DOJ would have made. They brought this appeal to the 11th yeah. Circuit for exactly these reasons,
yeah.
because the anomalous jurisdiction thing was always bollocks and they knew it. So,
yeah.
So they were going to be able to make the case fairly well, but he just, yeah, he kind of swooped
yeah.
in and did it.
He's kind of, yeah, he's expedited it that yes. much quicker, yeah. And it's really kind of quite neat that in prosecuting this case that the... Department of Justice got it. Okay, what we need a serious heavyweight guy who's an American. Oh, yeah. Jack Smith. Yeah. What's he done? He's brought people that affected genocide scale stuff in Europe. Yeah, that's what we need. And that's what it takes to burst the bubble of the bullshit surrounding Trump. It takes somebody that prosecutes regimes that brought about genocide-scaled atrocities on a war basis. We've got how is it that Trump supporters are complicit in what he does, that it needs that enormity of a prosecutor to come and deal with it and just push it all aside to go, yeah, on Thanksgiving and going, yes, what you've just said is bollocks.
Yeah.
What the fuck are you doing? It's that, and so it's the best of all worlds, but also a cruel indictment of how shit the support for Trump is, that they just let him get away with this stuff. But there's an American that does proper grown-up prosecution that's been employed by Americans to take Trump down and also point out how have we been complicit in not letting Trump be taken down for this long.
Yeah.
So it's both encouraging also dispiriting.
Well, it's difficult to say. Merrick Garland's approach in this has been methodical. Mm-hmm. It has been behind the scenes. He has said publicly the DOJ speaks through its court filings. They mm-hmm. they don't make statements about ongoing cases. They don't tell people yep. what they're doing. They are working diligently behind the scenes to build up these cases and get the evidence together and build a case that they know they can win,
yep.
most importantly. And the time frame is similar to the kind of, like the Watergate case,
right.
You know, in terms of how long things take to go from a point where you know something was done to getting all the evidence together in a way that means you can take it to court.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, it hasn't been quick, and that's frustrating, but I'd much rather they do it properly.
Than
go, oh, yeah, we should just, everyone knows he's guilty, it'll be fine.
Yeah. Everybody knows. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. So on one end, people think he's not guilty. On the other end, people think he is.
Yeah.
Let's he's just guilty find of half some the sort things. Of... Yeah. If he's guilty of half of the things, he's going to be in prison for 400 years.
Yeah. So, Smith has been doing other stuff as well as sending letters to the 11th Circuit. He's been subpoenaing people, which is fun.
Right, yeah.
He sent subpoenas to Brad Raffensperger and... Pat Cipollone and Patrick Philby, Pat Cipollone's deputy, to testify in front of a grand jury. And this is in reference to January 6th, essentially.
Yeah.
And their attempts to overturn the election. And with Raffensperger, obviously they have the phone call that Trump made saying that he wanted him to find 11,700
that there are receipts.
More votes.
Yeah.
So again, you know, the it's on tape, and he's definitely committing a crime.
And you think, well, why has nothing been done about that?
I mean, the people in Georgia have been working on that. There is a separate investigation underway, aside from the federal investigation that's going on in Georgia and into that case. And I think there was a separate grand jury impaneled in Georgia for that. So, it's happening on multiple fronts. Also, more recently, on December 6th, Smith subpoenaed several of the officials in the battleground states who were part of the fake elector scheme.
Right.
To try and get kind of, you know, alternate slates of electors who were prepared to say that Trump had won.
People that weren't official members of any kind of,
People who just got together in a Wendy's parking lot and said, Trump won.
Yeah.
It's fine. Let's make that claim.
How much are you giving us?
So that is also moving. So it seems like he's moving forward on multiple fronts. This is all the January 6th stuff, but there's every reason to believe that he's moving forward with the Mar-a-Lago case as well. In fact, just recently it's been announced that they found more documents, more classified, I think, documents, certainly ones they shouldn't have, in a storage facility. Supposedly, and I don't think this is a good argument, Trump doesn't even know kind of what's in the storage facility.
And that whole thing. Nobody cataloged it.
Like people. We've got so many. We had so many documents.
We just took loads of stuff.
I can't remember where I put all the documents. Some of them,
ignorance, no defense in the eyes of the law.
Basically, at the point a few months ago, after the raid on Mar-a-Lago, the search warrant, the DOJ asked again for assurances that they had definitely now got all of the secret documents.
Have we got everything?
Because previously, Trump's lawyers had signed a thing saying, we've looked everywhere, we've given you everything.
Yeah.
And they went, well, you know, we had a quick look and we found like hundreds of them. Can you check again?
Oh, we didn't know you were meant, we just look in there. Could you just check again, maybe?
Apparently, at least partly on that, the Trump Organization hired an outside team to do a search of
Like people with eyes.
Of other facilities owned by Trump or leased by Trump or whatever.
It's that kind of that. Have you ever watched that show where people buy the storage facilities abandoned ones? And you go, oh, I can't remember what it's called. It's that
Storage Wars, or there's a few of them. It's different.
It's going to turn up on that. There'll be a piece of camera going, yeah, we bought this thing, it's abandoned. We just opened it. It's just full of paper. We don't know what it is. There's some guy with a mullet who's reading it and going, this says top secret on here, Wilbur. Yeah. that's not worth anything. Is there any VCRs in there or some 8-tracks? Surely we could sell those. Exactly that. Could you just look again?
So the additional two additional documents with classified markings were found in this facility in Florida, and now they're pretty sure they've got everything.
Well, I guess it's a kind of toss-up between the National Archives going, well, we're expecting, 400 weight of this stuff. You have 3 truckloads. We've only got 2 truckloads. There's probably a truckload missing somewhere. Let's go look at the catacombs below Mar-a-Lago.
Well, you know, three truckloads, 0 truckloads. The truth is
somewhere in the middle. Often, and you see, and of course, the other point of view is that Trump kind of whined almost immediately when Trump told Fox News, of course, that it's not acceptable, it's so unfair, it's so political, and he goes, why is it? It's so unfair. It's so unfair.
Honestly, you can't
I
even
don't want it.
Can't even steal classified documents anymore.
No, you can't. As a president, you can't just take what
political
you want.
Greatness gone
and steal health and safety. Health and safety. Yeah. Gone. Yeah. No. Utter madness. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about this Christmas episode.
Of all the many, many legal cases involving Trump, it's a bit of a shame that the tax fraud case against the Trump Organization and the Trump Payroll Corporation didn't feature Trump himself as a defendant, particularly since the jury found them guilty of 17 counts of criminal tax fraud and falsifying business records. So the Trump Org is a convicted felon, but we'll have to wait a bit longer to say the same about Trump, since CFO Alan Weisselberg insisted on claiming Donald didn't know anything about the checks Trump signed to pay for Weisselberg's grandchild to go to a private school or the rental agreement Trump signed for Weisselberg's luxury apartment. While it's nowhere near as good as Trump getting convicted of anything at all, it's not nothing. On top of the roughly $1.6 million of fine, the Trump Org will have to declare the fact that it's a felon any time it wants to borrow money to buy or develop any property, which is the kind of thing that makes banks stop lending you money. The verdict also makes it very clear that it's possible to secure a conviction against something Trump-shaped, despite the ever-present danger of at least one red-hatted nutter being on the jury.
In what might be seen as an allegorical parallel to the question mark hanging over the future of Gareth Southgate as manager of the England national football team, having managed not to win the World Cup by missing several penalties again, RNC chair Rhonda McDaniel may be out of a job after 3 stints. Stints during which her team lost the House and the Senate, the presidential election, and in the midterms her team fell far short of expectations. Still, I guess it could be worse. There could be someone who fancies their chances in the role who's as stupid and ill-suited as, say, that MyPillow fat Rupert Pupkin guy Mike Lindell. Wait a minute, I'm just checking my notes. Yes, he's reckoned he's standing. In an online interview with Steve Bannon, Lindell said, in true Trump fashion, I'm all in. And one of the things that one of the big donors said to me, he said, Mike, everyone wants you to be head of the RNC. Some of them just don't know it yet. Well, it looks as though he's truly got the RNC running through his veins. After all, he was seen at the White House after January 6th attack with a paper with the words Insurrection Act and Martial Law if necessary on it, and the House Select Committee investigating January 6th subpoenaed his records, and more recently, the FBI served him with a search warrant 2 months ago, and at the time, agents seized his cell phone. So either he's a perfectly qualified shoo-in for the job, or Ronald McDaniel can be feeling a little more confident about staying for a fourth term.
In more Trump isn't going to prison yet, but this doesn't hurt legal news, Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes and co-defendant Kelly Meigs were found guilty of seditious conspiracy for their part in planning the January 6th insurrection. Naturally, we can't talk about Stuart Rhodes without mentioning, in the words of the Guardian article about the verdict, that he wears an eye patch after accidentally shooting himself in the face. But, arguably more importantly, he shot himself in the foot by putting so much of the planning in writing, with his many, many text messages playing a key role in the conviction, along with a recording the FBI obtained of him saying his only regret was that they hadn't taken rifles with them on the day, because if they had, they would have hanged Nancy Pelosi from a lamppost.
Surely you'd need rope for that, not rifles. Yeah.
This is the first seditious conspiracy conviction for almost three decades, but it probably won't be the last, since four other members of the Oath Keepers go on trial this month. Crucially, Rhodes didn't even enter the Capitol on January 6th, so what the prosecutors in this case have shown is that they can get a conviction against people who fomented the insurrection, even if they didn't take part in it, which is exactly the kind of result that should scare certain other insurrection fomenters.
Mm-hmm. On December 13th, the Respect for Marriage Act was signed into law. It requires the US federal government and all US states and territories to recognize the validity of same-sex and interracial civil marriages in the United States and protect religious liberty. As Indiana Republican Senator Todd, who votes for the act, said, "Dignity and respect are not a zero-sum proposition. We can and should strive to ensure all citizens enjoy them in equal measure. The Respect for Marriage Act moves us closer to that ideal." But it didn't stop him receiving letters of censure from the local Indiana Republican Party, who want to have the right to determine whether the legality of same-sex, interracial, or inter-religion marriages can be overridden at their state level, if they feel like it. Nor did it stop Laura Ingraham from ranting on Fox News that it was a bill that moves to restrict freedom of religion and freedom of speech, even meaning whether you're Catholic or evangelical or maybe Muslim, any serious person of faith, you will not necessarily have the right tomorrow that you had yesterday. No, Laura, you're wrong. That's the opposite of what it does. It secures marriage and religious rights so they don't go the same way as Roe v. Wade. What it actually does is take away your rights on the right to take away the rights of non-cis, non-WASP people you just happen to not like and think you know better than. Of course, you have the right to whine your ranty, biased, homophobic, racist opinion, but we have the right to call you out on all your fractal wrongness.
If you consume mainstream media, you definitely won't have heard of a thing called the Twitter Files. I'm reliably informed by responsible journalists such as Tucker Carlson, Dinesh D'Souza and Charlie Kirk that woke leftists at Washington Post, MSNBC and the like have actively suppressed stories about the most explosive evidence ever uncovered of election interference, First Amendment violations and bombshells that prove every conspiracy theory Trump followers ever theorised was undeniably true. It's definitely not the case that the reason that the lamestream media have ignored the Twitter files is because they're a series of boring internal communications that reveal no new information to anyone who's paid even the slightest attention over the past few years. The Twitter files, as Elon and his minions seem determined to call them, started as a 36-tweet thread by Matt Taibbi about Twitter's suppression of the Hunter Biden laptop story. As listeners to this show will already know, Twitter disabled links to the story in the New York Post due to their policy against hacked material and doxing, and then looked into the specific case and reversed their decision the very next day. This inability of Twitter's users to follow a link to a story for a day apparently lost Trump the election, leading to him calling this week for a termination of all rules, including the ones in the Constitution, which seems like a bit of an overreaction. One of the smoking guns that various right-wingers pointed to as evidence of the government using Twitter to violate the First Amendment was an exchange of emails in which one content moderator sent a series of links to tweets which the Biden campaign had alerted them to. A reply came back simply saying, "Handled." Setting aside for the moment the fact that Trump was president at the time, so a private citizen asking a private company to take down tweets has nothing to do with the First Amendment, some proper journalists actually looked up what those tweets involved, and they were all pictures of Hunter Biden's dick. Twitter's policy against posting news without the consent of the subject meant they were right to remove them. I could go into more detail about the rest of the Twitter files, but ultimately every single one comes down to private company moderates content on their own platform.
Yep. Little ray of sunshine, Brian K. Pritchard is running in a January 3rd special election to replace former Georgia Speaker of the House David Ralston, who died shortly after winning the election last month. Pritchard isn't a ray of sunshine. He's straight out of central casting, right-wing, online, web show, ranty, cat's arse of a mouth, picky-eyed, spray-on grey hair, fat, loud-mouthed election denier. You know, the kind of description you type into an AI image generator. He's a prime candidate. Since the office of Georgia Attorney General Chris Carr, one of the officials Pritchard accused of being complicit in the stolen election, said in a filing that Pritchard had illegally voted five times in 2008 and four times in 2010 while still on probation after he pleaded guilty in 1996 to felony, forgery and theft charges in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania. In Georgia, former felons aren't allowed to vote until they've completed their sentence, which includes probation. In further proof of the suitability of his candidacy as a potential lawmaker, Pritchard said he was not aware he was considered a felon when he cast his ballots. He also said in an intimidating and bullying phone call to Dawson County News, "I will not be intimidated. I will not be bullied. No one's going to keep me out of this race," which is kind of true, as the hearing vis-a-vis his nine stolen, illegal and fraudulent votes is requested for the week of 9th of January, which is technically after the special election, though he faces up to $45,000 in fines and, if criminally charged, well, who knows, he may end up being a presidential candidate alongside all of the other deliberately unwitting fuckwit crooks in the GOP, I guess.
I've been waiting with bated breath all day because yesterday, as we record this, Trump announced that today he would be making a major announcement. Ooh. The last time he announced an announcement in advance was the launch of his campaign to get re-elected, so obviously everyone was expecting something big. Social media sites lit up with speculation that he was running for Speaker of the House or that he would shun convention and name his vice president, who everyone was pretty sure would be Carrie Lake. I briefly enjoyed the idea that he might announce he'd had enough of the lies and corruption and he was giving himself up to the authorities to face whatever judgment he had coming. I mean, obviously it wasn't that. But nobody expected that the major announcement would in fact be his dumbest, most pathetic grift, well, this year at least. Yes, he's releasing a series of digital NFT trading cards featuring his face crappily photoshopped into various outfits, including astronaut, cowboy, fighter pilot and sheriff, like the worst possible combination of the village people and Mr. Ben.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a niche reference, admittedly. But
yeah,
you can own one of these JPEGs by, well, just right-clicking and saving it to your hard drive. But you can own it in the far stupider NFT sense by paying Trump a mere $99 per card.
It's so cheap.
But yeah, don't stop at one like some kind of woke beta male cuck. If you buy just 45 of the shoddily drawn useless pieces of shit, you'll get to have dinner with Trump himself. That's less than $4,500 for an overcooked steak with a man who definitely will not talk about anything other than himself. Yeah. And that's assuming he bothers to go through with it rather than bailing on the dinner like he did to various winners of who can donate the most money competitions during his first campaign. Don't all rush at once.
And I love the fact that the advert, when he does it, they haven't even bothered to make up the fact that he's not sweaty. He's just, he's really shiny.
It's so
really
bad.
Awful. They're kind
I mean,
of...
they clearly haven't spent any time making them at all. That, I reckon they got Melania to do it. They were just you know,
well,
any
she's one
idiot
of the world,
can do
world
this.
Leaders. Yeah, but it's okay, if Marvel were going to do... So forget about Time magazine. You want to end up on the front of Superhero Weekly, Marvel magazine. So just Photoshop your face into some rippling pecs.
I mean, basically...
Laden.
If they had... I don't know if they have them in America, but in Britain, certainly in the 70s, at Seasides, they had these things with like big bits of cardboard with paintings on and a hole for your head. So you put your head through and someone takes a picture of you and you look like a mermaid or a cowboy or whatever. Or
being held by a fat, overweight
If they'd done that, it would have been significantly better quality.
Convincing. They were terrible. And they're terrible because you can never get your face in the right. And they're awful. And they would have been much more convincing. Shit. That's brilliant. Well, here in free, fair, equal and supportive Blighty, postal workers, rail and bus workers, airport baggage handlers, border force security, driving instructors, nurses, ambulance workers and other health staff are amongst the hard-working people of Britain, celebrated on millions of doorsteps during the pandemic for being key workers. They are also the representatives of the hard-working people currently asking for their pay and conditions to be improved through an ongoing series of industrial actions / strikes throughout December. And they appear to be supported by the vast majority of other hard-working people of Britain, despite this month's Tory Prime Minister Rishi Sunak saying it's damaging the lives of the hard-working people of Britain. Yeah, it's such a long list that that's a bit disingenuous of Rishi at the very least, because they pretty much are all of the hard-working people of Britain. Since the billions spent by the Tory government on tax cuts for bankers and VIP lane dodgy PPE and track and trace deals for their mates, pay rises for anyone else are apparently unaffordable. Unaffordable apart from simply enacting, say, a 1% wealth tax on households worth over £1 million or windfall taxes on billion profit-making energy firms. But ever mindful of strike protocol, Rishi cannot conceive the notion of crossing the picket lines of dogmatic Tory thought and simply speaks to the unions representing the interests of the hard-working people of Britain, as it might compromise the position of the non-dom people whose hard-working businesses are in Britain but who pay no tax in Britain, one of whom was Rishi's wife until very recently, / Tory party donors, / think tanks. We're nearly 50 years on. 50 years on from the winter of discontent that saw the downfall of Edward Heath's Tory government in the 1970s. And in their lauding of the union-bashing ghost of Margaret Thatcher, the Tories seem to have learned nothing. And of course, as ever since Dickens' time, the hard-working people of Britain are suffering as part of their little bit of history repeating lesson. Let's hope it doesn't take a general strike or the appearance of three conscience-driven ghosts in Rishi's pyjamas to change the fucker's stance. God bless us, everyone. Yeah, Merry Christmas to you and all, Tiny Tim.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this Christmas. You'll find the show notes at fallaciouStrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you had a good time this Christmas, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or simply tell one other person in person about how much they'd like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump, just like our newest patron, Don Tuvey, our strawman level patrons, Schmutz, Mark Reiki, and Amber R. Buchanan, who told us when we met her at QED, we can just call her Amber. And our true Scotsman level patrons, Stephen Bickle, Janet Uatta, Kaz Tui, Andrew Houck, Max Beaver, and our top patron, Lauren. Thank you so much for your support, everybody, throughout the years you've been doing it. It's fantastic. Thank you. We can't do it without you.
And you can connect with those awesome people, as well as us and other listeners, in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallaciouStrump.
All music was by The Outburst and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last Christmas word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.